The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Talk radio that makes a difference.
Makes a difference.
This is Bob Burney Live.
Just a few minutes before we went on the air, I read an interesting editorial, The Cross in the Crosshairs, and it's a fascinating editorial about the Supreme Court decision last week concerning the Bladensburg Cross, which I think is a real win for religious freedom and liberty. Well, one of the organizations very important in the battle for religious freedom and liberty is the Family Research Council. And it's my privilege to welcome to the program Travis Weber, who is Vice President for Policy and Director of the Center for Religious Liberty at the Family Research Council. Travis Weber, welcome to Bob Burney Live. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time this afternoon.
Thanks very much for having me on.
It is my pleasure. How important is this decision by the Supreme Court concerning the Bladensburg Cross?
Yeah, I mean, I think the decision is very important. Although the result or the court's opinion is quite fractured, and there's a lot of different opinions by different justices, the end result is a positive one. And while I leave some things that need to be accomplished in the court's approach to the Establishment Clause moving forward, this opinion definitely builds on some of the other positive opinions we've seen in recent years and begins to articulate a good originalist approach to religiously themed monuments, public displays of religion in other cases that may arise.
Now, you used an interesting phrase. You said that the decision was a fractured decision. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, so you had 7 votes in favor of letting this monument stand, but there were not 7 votes joining the majority opinion. The majority opinion, or the opinion for the court written by Justice Alito, was joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Breyer, Kavanaugh, and then in parts, Kagan. So you had 5 votes for some parts of that opinion, which laid out this a rationale, basically, that looked to the historical role of the monument, said that when these monuments are rooted in history, they're more likely to stand, and built on some of the other Establishment Clause cases in making that case. Then there were 2 parts of that opinion that really critiqued the Lemon test and said Lemon, which is a case several decades old, that provides an approach to Establishment Clause cases which allows for very subjective readings of this area of the law, allows judges to strike down a lot of these public monuments, and has not been applied in many cases. The majority in 2 subsections really critique that. Kagan did not want to join those. I think they were too strong against Lemon for her taste, but you had 4 justices join those. Justice Gorsuch and Thomas did not join the majority. I think they did not agree with its rationale. But given that they would likely favorably view opposition to Lemon, you really have 6 justices who would be ready to strongly critique or ditch the Lemon test, which is a very positive sign. Justices Kagan and Breyer also laid out concurring opinions explaining and clarifying their views. Justice Gorsuch had a concurring opinion criticizing offended observer standing, which allows people to even get before the court to complain about these monuments in Establishment Clause cases. And Justice Thomas had a concurring opinion explaining how, in his view, the Establishment Clause does not even apply to the states at all, just the federal government. So a lot of different opinions. There was also a dissent by Ginsburg and Sotomayor. A lot of different opinions, but overall some positive movement on Establishment Clause law.
I'm sure you're familiar with Al Mohler, the president of the Southern Seminary. He just released an editorial for our Salem radio network. And this is not verbatim, but Al Mohler basically said this decision basically kills the Lemon test. Would you concur with that?
I would say that if you add up and read the court's opinions overall, I would say it comes close to basically killing. I think basically kills is a little bit too strong, because for one, you don't have a majority opinion that basically kills the test. You have to read into the subsections of the majority that Kagan did not join and look at the concurrence, which, by the way, Kavanaugh also wrote a concurring opinion strongly undermining Lemon. That was good to see. But you really need to add up some different opinions, add up the fact that Thomas and Gorsuch did not join the majority, but they probably would agree with the majority's critique of Lemon. They just didn't agree with the rationale of the opinion overall. So you do have six who are ready to strongly undermine it, but they didn't do so in this case. But I think reading the signs overall, I would say strongly undermine. I wouldn't say basically kills, but we come close to that. I actually had a blog for SCOTUS blog as part of their symposium on a case, arguing that this lays the groundwork for the downfall of Lemon. So I would say it puts the groundwork in place for Lemon to be killed sometime soon.
Okay.
Doesn't basically kill it yet.
And I don't want to misrepresent Al Mohler. He didn't say it was killed, but it was kind of implied. And he quotes Gorsuch in Gorsuch's opinion on this, quote, Lemon was a misadventure. Are you surprised that a Supreme Court justice would say something about the Lemon test that has been used for such a long time? Does this really indicate a huge change of direction for the Supreme Court on religious freedom issues?
I think this is significant because you have really six justices who are ready to be strongly critical of it. You add up the different positions and different opinions. Justice Gorsuch, we can expect a strong critique from him. If we had nine Gorsuches on the court, this would be decided a while, you know, it would have already been decided. But
yeah.
But basically, it's a move in the right direction in a significant manner. Lemon, though, has been critiqued by a variety of scholars for a long time in a variety of opinions, yet it's still around somehow,
yeah.
Still available for lower court judges to use. So we nearly need to put the nail in the coffin, and that has not happened yet.
And again, I am not an attorney. How would this happen? How would the Supreme Court put to death, finally, once and for all, the Lemon test? Would this come in the shape of a decision in a particular case? Or how would the Lemon test be killed by the Supreme Court?
I think it could arise in another establishment clause case in which the court at that time finally takes the opportunity to get rid of the test. I do think you have enough votes on the court to do that. We just need the right case to arise in the right context, because remember, the question here was whether this monument violates the Establishment Clause. So when the court can look to other cases and principles to decide that, as it did in this case, it's not forced to ditch the Lemon test. But basically, the cases need to develop in a way to which the court is, you know, moving towards the ledge of ditching Lemon, and then one case is the one that pushes it over. I think that could arise very soon, given the comments and positions of justices in this case. The other factor, you know, frankly, is when we know judicial nominations have been very important in a lot of these cases, and how a judge's philosophy, whether they have an originalist philosophy. Lemon is not an originalist case.
Yeah.
And we get a few more Gorsuches on the court, and you're going to be in a position where it's almost certainly going to happen.
We're talking with Travis Weber, Vice President for Policy and Director of the Center for Religious Liberty at the Family Research Council. We don't have a whole lot of time left, Travis, and let's change gears completely. I'd just be interested. The heartbeat bills that have popped up all over the country, we know will be going to the Supreme Court probably in the near future. What is your gut feeling about how the Supreme Court is going to rule on these heartbeat bills? And could this be the end of Roe v. Wade?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. There's been so many pro-life efforts in the states that have been popping up recently, a variety of types of measures. Some are already at the court. Indiana, there was a pro-life law affecting several different areas related to abortion. We saw one passed in Missouri recently. But some of these have already been reached in the court, different types of laws. One from Louisiana about clinic and doctor regulations, and the court has been taking action on them, but ultimately no serious, substantial opinions on the merits since the Hellerstadt decision of several years ago that dealt with clinic regulations in Texas. I think it's the way Heartbeat or anything else reaches the court is going to be in this wider context of abortion law. And I think what's more likely to happen is some sort of regulation or law affecting abortion is upheld finally in a departure from the Hellerstadt case and Casey versus Planned Parenthood from several decades ago. I think if they try to bring a heartbeat bill right now to the court off the bat, the court, looking at the current jurisprudence, is not going to uphold it on its face. But obviously, if one of these reaches the court after several of these other types of cases reach the court that are easier for the court to uphold under current abortion law, you're going to see an heartbeat bill possibly upheld at some point. I think the other thing to remember, obviously the court looks at the public's perception of these issues and they look at the pro-life momentum. They're not blind to these things. And while they shouldn't decide cases based off them, certainly a factor in how the court looks at these things, I would argue so many of these social issues shouldn't even be before the Supreme Court anyway, because they're not constitutional matters. They're matters that should be simply decided in the states. But yeah. Nevertheless, we can expect movement on the question of abortion in the Supreme Court in the coming years.
We've been talking with Travis Weber, Vice President for Policy and Director of the Center for Religious Liberty at the Family Research Council. To learn more about the Family Research Council, go to frc.org. Travis, thank you so much for your time. Hope we can have you back on sometime soon.
Anytime at all.
All right. Bobberty Live will continue. Stay tuned.
Bob Burney Live. Looking at today's news through a biblical worldview.
Well, we were just talking about religious liberty and freedom here in America. It is clear which political party stands for liberty and which political party wants to remove your liberty. Now, folks, I say it all the time, but I feel like I have to keep repeating it. I am not a Republican loyalist. Far from it. I am not in any way, shape, or form a loyalist to the Republican Party. I got all kinds of problems with Republicans, particularly here in the state of Ohio. Our Republican Party, in many ways here in Ohio, especially Franklin County, don't get me started on the Republican Franklin, the Republican Party in Franklin County. But anyway, however, with that said, there is such a dramatic difference between the Republicans and the Democrats when it comes to religious freedom and liberty. Republicans are not perfect, far, far, far from it, but the Democrats, my goodness, here is the headline. Democrat-controlled House panel debates whether to weaken landmark religious freedom law. The law in question is RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, let's go back in history just a little bit. RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, was passed in 1993. It was passed with bipartisan support. The support in both the House of Representatives and the Senate was almost unanimous. And it was signed into law by no one other than Bill Clinton, who was president. So get this, because here's what I want to illustrate. How the Democratic Party has, Democrat Party, it's not really the Democratic Party, the Democrat Party, how it has changed in a very short period of time. In 1993, House of Representatives and the Senate, with almost unanimous support from Republicans and Democrats, RFRA was passed, 1993, signed into law by a Democrat president, Bill Clinton. Fast forward to 2019. The same piece of legislation that Democrats supported almost unanimously, and it was supported wholeheartedly by Democrats today in 2019, Democrats want to overturn it, and if they can't overturn it, they want to weaken it significantly. That give you any indication of how things have changed? Now, again, if you go back historically, the law was a reaction to a Supreme Court decision. Some of you may remember this. A Supreme Court decision opposing the rights of members of the Native American Church to use peyote. Remember that? Native Americans, American Indians, wanted to use peyote as a part of their religious rituals. Now, it's a hallucinogenic drug. It's like LSD. But as weird as it sounds, as bizarre as it sounds, it had been a part of their religious rituals for a long, long, long time. And so RFRA was passed with huge support from Democrats and a Democrat president in order to protect the weird, bizarre, strange, but sincerely held religious beliefs of Native Americans. Fast forward to today. RFRA has been used on several occasions to support the religious freedom rights for Christians. And they're not weird, bizarre, crazy. Just religious convictions about marriage, family, and so forth. So get this. In 1993, Democrats wanted to protect Native Americans in their religious rituals to smoke and to take hallucinogenic drugs. But Christians who want to adhere to convictions that they have held for 2,000 years should not be protected. Think about how weird and bizarre that is. So there are hearings being held right now. The House Committee on Education and Labor are holding hearings on, quote, do no harm, examining the misapplication of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So once again, to use it to protect Indians to get high on hallucinogenic drugs is fine, but to use it for Christians to practice firmly held convictions that they've had for 2,000 years is a misapplication.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.